Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about predictions that the Democrats will lose seats in 2010, and we'll examine why they and President Obama are suffering from buyer's remorse so soon after the Democrats' resounding victories in 2008. We'll be joined by Nate Silver, who is a statistician, analyst, journalist, and writer. His website is 538.com. He regularly appears online in print and on the broadcast media as an electoral and political analyst. He accurately predicted the winners in 49 of the 50 states in the 2008 elections. And in April of 2009, he was named by Time magazine as one of the world's 100 most influential people. And then on this Labor Day weekend, we'll look at the jobless recovery and how much capital is winning and labor is losing. We'll be joined by Dr. Lawrence Michel, who's an economist, author, and analyst, who's the president of the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan economic research institution in Washington, D.C., that focuses primarily on economic trends that affect the lives and living standards of working people. He is the principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. And Dr. Michel has, and a co-author economist Heidi Shierholz, have just released a new paper, The Recession's Hidden Costs. And continuing on this Labor Day weekend, we'll examine the situation of those who actually have jobs and are being cheated by their employers. We'll be joined by Dr. Ruth Milkman, professor of sociology at UCLA, where she also directs the UCLA Institute for Industrial Relations, and Dr. Nick Theodore, who's director of the Center for Urban Economic Development and an associate professor in the Department of Urban Planning and Policy at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Dr. Milkman and Dr. Theodore are part of a team of national labor market experts which has just released a groundbreaking study of the low-wage workforce in the nation's three largest cities, finding that core employment laws like the minimum wage and overtime pay are being aggressively and systematically violated by some of the economy's fastest-growing industries. This report, entitled Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers, Violations of Labor Laws in American Cities, can be viewed at unprotectedworkers.org. So let's begin with Nate Silver again. Nate Silver is a statistician, analyst, journalist, and writer. His website is 538.com, and he accurately predicted the winners in 49 of the 50 states in the 2008 election, and in April of 2009 was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. And Nate Silver, the prediction that the Democrats will lose in 2010, whatever the numbers are, it's hard to understand. Is this a case of the American people being incredibly fickle, or is this something to do with a kind of buyer's remorse that's going on? It's so soon after the after.
Yeah, I think yes to both questions, at least in part. I mean, we have to remember this is a country that, in 2008, elected Barack Obama with the 53% margin, but the two elections before that had elected George W. Bush, who's kind of on the opposite side of the political spectrum. I think the country is never quite as liberal as it seems or quite as conservative as it seems. I mean, even when you do have, a president like Obama who won a decisive victory, still, 47 out of every 50 people, out of every 100 people, voted against him. And so it doesn't take that much at the margins for a few swing voters to start feeling differently about a candidate and to kind of change the landscape, I suppose.
But there's also within these analyses that you do, there's this paradox that the American people are much more centrist and they don't particularly like the far left or the far right, and they certainly don't like the political discourse being hijacked by either the far right or the far left. But on the other hand, we have a Congress that has been gerrymandered so much into safe seats that they tend to elect far-right and far-left people.
That's right. There are far fewer competitive congressional districts than there ever have been before, where because of the gerrymandering, you have districts where, like the one I live in Brooklyn, New York, 90% of people here voted for Barack Obama. And there are others where you have, you know, 75 or 80% of people voted for John McCain when he'd lost the election. And so that seems to be getting, you know, worse and worse every year. And you're absolutely right. You know, almost all members of the Congress kind of line up either to the right or the left of the American people. And there are very few true kind of centrists, moderates anymore. You have, I guess, a couple of women up in Maine who are, for all intents and purposes, independent. In the Democratic Party, you have more blue dogs, and some it's because they're representing conservative states like Nebraska. In other cases, it's because they tend to get a lot of money from corporations and special interests, and so they might not be representing their constituents so much as kind of representing their wallets.
Right. And they're the people that are most in jeopardy, I understand, from your analysis of those who would lose seats in 2010. And that's another paradox that I don't understand, Nate Silver. These are the people who Rahm Emanuel recruited, and they are the reason why the Democrats increased their margin. So why would these blue dogs vote against health care, which would then cause the public to want to reject the Democrats?
Well, I think partly it's because they're looking at the poll numbers and kind of thinking, well, you know, this bill started out being fairly popular, and then as it's kind of gotten beat up in July and especially last month in August, I think they're worried they're kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't, where it's a bill that might be only marginally popular or even somewhat unpopular. We'll see what happens with the big speech Obama is delivering next week. On the other hand, they know what happened in 1994. It wasn't the liberal Democrats getting kicked out of Congress in 1994. It was the equivalent of the blue dogs and some of the old moderates in the South. Some of that was kind of a long time in coming, kind of generational. But they know kind of the first hired, first fired is kind of the principle with congressional elections. The one who picked up seats in 2006 and 2008 in districts that are somewhat more Republican or have been more marginal for Democrats, they're the ones who are more likely than not going to lose. So if, you know, Obama's approval numbers are sitting somewhere at 40% or something come next November.
So how did the Democrats lose the momentum so quickly? And is it because they haven't, I mean, for a while, obviously, President Obama could keep saying that, look, I inherited this incredible mess, which he clearly did, and I inherited these wars, and the legacy of George W. Bush was pretty unpopular, which is why, in part, they won so resoundingly in 2008. But that message obviously doesn't last very long. But on the other hand, the populist anger that's out there about what happened on Wall Street, what happened with GM and Chrysler going under, and these unpopular wars, it seems that the conservatives in the right wing have been able to tap that populist anger and turn it to their advantage, rather than the Democrats, who should be able to use that populist anger to further indicate Republican bankruptcy.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with things like the bailout package. And let's remember, this started as an initiative which was sponsored by the Bush administration and by Hank Paulson, although the Obama people did enthusiastically urge people in Congress to vote for the second half of the TARP funding, for instance. But that's the kind of thing where it's not a real easy sell with the public. And we talk about how it's hard to pass an unpopular bill. That bill was very unpopular. It costs a lot of money, and that causes a lot of fatigue, I think, and people wondering on all sides. I mean, I do think that some of the anger you see at these town hall meetings about health care, it's really about a million different things, of which health care is kind of one one component. And people see the big price tag. I think it's unfortunate kind of coincidence for the Democrats that all these bills seem to have the same price tag. The stimulus cost about $820 billion. The bailout was in the range of $800 billion. Health care, they're trying to get down to $900, $800, $700 billion. So people kind of see the same big thing and maybe don't distinguish between something like health care. It will save a lot of Americans from not having insurance or from having to pay too much for it themselves, from something like the bailout, where it might be necessary to kind of prevent the economy from collapsing, which it hasn't. The recession is still ongoing, but we haven't had a total meltdown like some people feared. But in some ways, it's almost like the argument that the Bush administration used to make about 9/11. Hey, we've kept the country safe ever since. It's kind of hard to argue a negative there, where we you know, they feel Treasury has prevented a total economic nightmare, but people weren't convinced it was going to happen anyway. And you can't, it's not a good sales pitch. People don't feel like they got their money's worth for all that money that was spent. And they see, you know, all the problems that you mentioned with Afghanistan as well, that once were the Bush administration's problem become inherited, and the further we get away from last November, the more people forget about that and just say, here's a guy in charge. Democrats have 60 or now 59 seats in the Senate, all sorts of majority in the House. If things aren't going well, it's just the generic anger kind of tends to turn against the ruling party, and that in this case is the Democrats.
But it does seem, though, that not just the town hall meetings, but the tea bags and others, there's more. There seems to be more organization and a kind of more consistent message. Even though it's fundamentally inaccurate, they nevertheless have been able to channel a lot of this rage to their advantage, the Republicans. Why? I mean, is it because there seems to be a certain amount of incoherence on the Democratic side, not just about what this health care bill is, which presumably there'll be some clarity delivered by President Obama on Wednesday night. There's an expectation that some of the drift will be reversed. But just Nate Silvey, perhaps it's just I'm asking for a personal opinion here rather than an analytical one, but what is the reason for the poor messaging on the part of Democrats? Because they seem to basically, the message that the other side destroyed the economy is still real. We're going to be talking about unemployment in a little while. The reality is going to get worse by 2010, apparently. So you'd think that they'd want to get out ahead of this.
Well, one issue the Democrats have, and it's kind of an irony of being a party where you are in the majority, is that they have a lot of different constituencies they're representing. It's not so much like the right wing, where they all kind of seem to believe in, you know, 9 out of 10 of the same things, where you have some Democrats who are more kind of libertarian-leaning. You have some maybe more union Democrats that are more populist in terms of their messaging. You have some who have issues like gay marriage, which they feel are not being pursued aggressively enough by the White House. And so the problem with having a big tent is that you have a lot of little kind of infighting in that tent. And I think one reason why they've had such difficulty explaining what the health care bill is to the public is because there isn't a health care bill yet. There are, you know, 5 or 6 different versions floating around the Congress, none of which exactly match the one Obama had on the campaign trail. I had said up front, I think that Obama has to lay a few more specifics on the table and not be afraid to muscle Congress around, because when this process started, his approval was in the 60s. Congress's wasn't. People didn't like Congress. They almost never do. He seemed a bit too deferential to the Congress. I think they wanted to avoid the mistake that Bill Clinton had made in 1994, where they had a panel and kind of literally put a bill on Congress's doorstep. But you can definitely go too far the other way, where you have people like Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid selling the bill, and people didn't vote for them, you know, to represent them in the White House. They're not terribly popular. Democrats, I think, have something of a dearth of compelling spokespeople in the Congress. I think someone like former Senator Clinton could have maybe been more valuable in that role. Of course, she is now Secretary of State, and that's a problem for them as well.
Of course, seniority would have denied her any possibility to be a Senate leader, which obviously the Democrats desperately need. Nobody seems to think that Harry Reid is particularly inspiring, and I think the same applies to Nancy Pelosi. But in terms of how much the Blue Dogs are compromised, you mentioned earlier that they are also taking money from the same special interests that seem to have all the Republicans on board. How much is this really at the heart of the problem here? That, and again, in terms of messaging, because the more you read about what's happened to Wall Street and the bailout of Wall Street by the beleaguered taxpayer, it's now becoming in clearer that, in fact, the banks are getting stronger and fewer, and the problem, the moral hazard problem of being too big to fail, is actually increased. So, in effect, it's almost as though Wall Street has more power than Washington.
It does seem that way sometimes. And we've looked at a couple of different bills. Like, for example, if you look at who has pledged support for the public option, and you can run analyses and actually see the relationship between the amount of lobbying money a congressman's gotten and their stance on that issue. And it's pretty strong. The way we estimate, there are probably 8 or 9 senators who might support the public option if they were voting just based on their kind of constituents' views, but don't because they're getting more money from, you know, insurance interests and stuff. And another problem, too, is especially in some of these smaller states, whether it's a Montana or a Wyoming or something like that, where you don't have very many constituents to raise money from, you can still get PAC money from any corporation, any lobbying group in the country. And so you have some senators where almost half their funding now is from, or even more, is from special interest groups. And, of course, if that's kind of who's, you know, who's buttering your bread, then your votes are more likely than not going to reflect that. I think, you know, I think there's becoming a little bit more transparency on that stuff. As this data gets out there, people become more cognizant of it. But you know, with the fact that small states tend to be overrepresented in the Senate anyway, where, you know, California has as many senators as Delaware or something, and the smaller states you tend to have people relatively more influenced by, you know, corporate money, is an unfortunate circumstance for the Democrats.
And do you think that the problem, Nate Silver, and why the Democrats don't come out with a stronger message? I mean, it seems to me that they should have from the day one talked about rescuing Main Street and not Wall Street. And it is, after all, the taxpayers who've rescued these people who are now basically are the only ones who do. This is a jobless recovery where capital is doing great and labor is not. So it's pretty ironic. And in spite of the protests about the stimulus package that passed, it seems to me that that's actually starting to show some results. And the cash for clunkers thing showed some results. So why aren't they taking more credit for what's working in terms of, you know, we're standing up for Main Street and we're trying to revive Main Street? And the other guys are only interested in taking care of the people who take care of them. Is that just too populist, or are they compromised with the fact that they've taken so much money from Wall Street? I just don't get it.
It's a tough question, Ann, especially with that stimulus package, where we talk about some of the job creation components, and some of those are only kind of coming online now. But that bill also included about $350 billion in tax cuts, what most of which was directly to taxpayers. And we almost never hear the Obama administration say, "Hey, we just passed a gigantic tax cut, you know, so if you're calling us a bunch of socialists or whatever else, we're trying to kind of give people a break. And by the way, all these people in your states who are unemployed now for 6 months and their unemployment insurance is running out, we extended that, you know, as bad as some states like California had a budget crisis. The stimulus relieved a lot of pressure there. But they seem afraid to, I don't know, kind of promote that. I think they don't want to appear insensitive where they're saying, hey, the economy is getting better, where some numbers are looking better, but not the jobs numbers at all yet. But they're a little overcautious, I think, in a number of different areas. And maybe they have some brilliant longer-term game plan, and we'll see a terrific speech. I think it will be a good speech in front of the Congress next week. But, you know, ironically, some of the claims that Hillary made about him being inexperienced don't maybe apply to foreign policy, where he seems to have the hang of things, and, you know, people on all sides of the aisle seem to be pleased with his foreign relations. But, you know, domestically, to know how to sell a bill to the public, to know how to win, you know, news cycle after news cycle, to know which things are easier and harder, they sometimes seem to be, you know, a little bit out of tune on certain things.
And just in closing, Nate Silver, what price are they going to pay by your analysis in 2010 in the House and Senate?
Well, I think there's a wide range in the House where if the economy is looking a little better, if they get some kind of health care bill passed, and I think what they passed might not be terribly popular, but it's still probably better than failing to pass anything at all, then they might get away with losing a handful of seats, maybe a net of 5 or 10. That almost always happens when you have a new party taking over the White House. They won't have the same enthusiasm they had in 2008. That's a good outcome, actually, historically, to lose, you know, say anywhere between a half dozen and a dozen seats would be a victory, a moral victory for the Democrats. On the downside, though, if the economy goes into some sort of double-dip recession, if unemployment it hits 10.5%, if there's no health care bill passed, if they can't learn how to kind of control the narrative a little bit more, you could see a loss, I would think, of, you know, as many as 40 or 50 seats, which would mean they would lose the Congress, the House, not the Senate. The Senate, they're a little bit safer. But on the House side, you have a lot of polls now showing a generic congressional ballot is tied, that you ask people all over the country, who do you plan to vote for in 2010, not by name, but they say there is likely now to say the Republican is a Democrat. If that's the case, you have to go back to a case where the House is about evenly split, and that would require the Democrats to lose, I think, 39 or so seats. So the kind of the worst-case scenarios, in my opinion, are still kind of worst-case scenarios, but are absolutely on the table for the Democrats, where you've seen very big, very kind of quick shifts in public sentiment before, and there are some indications we might see one again come next November.
Well, the message ought to be clear. If you've got a majority, you've got to use a majority and deliver. If you don't deliver, you get punished, and you lose your majority. It's pretty simple, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there are a lot of parallels to what Clinton experienced in 1994, and we do have to remember, too, Clinton recovered and had six more years as president, where he was quite popular for most of that time. Ronald Reagan in 1980 and 82, he lost quite a few seats. The Republicans did, and they recovered and had what most people consider a successful presidency, certainly. So, you know, the last chapter won't be written in November 2010. I still think in terms of 2012, you know, the Republican presidential candidates are uninspiring. And in a presidential election, you have to actually stand for something and not just against what the other party is proposing. But if you're having a referendum on, you know, what Congress has done, then based on the kind of trends I'm seeing right now, it could be fairly ugly for the Democrats, at least in the near term, meaning next year.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Nate Silver.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Nate Silver, whose website is 538.com. He accurately predicted the winners of 49 of the 50 states in the 2008 election, and in April of 2009, he was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine. I'm now speaking with Dr. Lawrence Michel, who's an economist, author, and analyst, who's president of the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan economic research institution in Washington, D.C., that focuses primarily on economic trends that affect the lives of living standards of working people. He is a principal author of a research volume published every 2 years that is widely considered the authoritative text on the American workforce, The State of Working America. And he's the co-author with economist Heidi Shierholz. They've just released a paper, The Recession's Hidden Cost. And we have, Dr. Michel, we've got the announcement that we've just reached a 26-year high in unemployment, an official figure of 9.7%. But then if you include part-time workers who'd prefer to have full-time jobs and people who want to work but have given up looking, the figure actually is 16.8%. So let's begin with that. Which is the better indicator?
Well, I think we need to look at both. I think we are in the deepest and longest recession since the 1930s. Unemployment's been rising since the early spring of 2007. It's already risen a larger amount than even the horrible recession of the 1980s, and we're not done yet. We're at 9.7% unemployment. We're going to go up to somewhere between 10 and 10.5%, and it will likely keep rising through the middle of next year and if things go really badly, until the end of next year.
Well, the Bloomberg's quoting a J.P. Morgan Chase economist who used to work for the Federal Reserve, Michael Feroli. He's saying it's great for business and terrible for households. Now, doesn't that really encapsulate what the issue is here? And this has been going on for I believe since the 1970s, that wages, household income and wages have been flat, but the results and the benefits of productivity have spiked upwards. So for the longest time, capital has been winning out and labor has been losing. Isn't that and of course these statistics that are just released indicate that the gap is even widening. But is this the new face of global capitalism?
Well, I think an assessment of the prior 30 years from the 1970s up through the beginning of this recession, you know, you would say that you know, working people increased their efficiency and productivity, were producing more, and made very few gains in terms of the increase in their compensation, far behind the growth of what they produced for the economy, and that almost all of the growth went to people at the top. Since 1989, for instance, only 15% of the economic growth went to the bottom 90%. And the top tenth of the top 1%, one out of 1,000 families, gained around 33% of the income. So, yeah, we had a very unbalanced economy. That's partly what threw us into this recession. But I think the way to understand the recession is the following. We had a philosophy of laissez-faire market economics, anything goes economics for 30 years, you know, bank deregulation and all that. And that threw us into a global recession. President Obama inherited a really awful economy that was rapidly descending downhill. Last March, the unemployment rate was already 8.5% before his recovery package, you know, the ink on it was even dry. I give them pretty high marks for the recovery package, and it was pretty big and bold. But the thing is, when you're thrown into a really deep hole, you need, you know, something so huge to get out of it. And what happened is we passed the recovery package. It's actually saved, you know, over a million jobs so far in our estimate, and the economy itself will stop shrinking this summer. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is no one's really going to feel like it's going well until we actually see a lot of jobs being created and unemployment going down and wages starting to grow faster than inflation. All those things aren't happening, and so it's hard, you know, to declare victory, nor should we. You know, it's my view that we actually need the federal government to step in and do even more stimulus in order to get the unemployment rate down quickly, because, you know, 2 years from now, I think we're still going to have unemployment above 8%, and it's totally unacceptable, and it's going to do untold damage to families and children. Just in today's front page of the New York Times, an article about all of the kids that are homeless or have housing problems and all the problems that's going to present them in school. You know, the effect of this recession is really huge, and I fear that the political class, the punditry, et cetera, is sort of saying, well, we've already dealt with this. Now everybody's got to tough it out. I'm horrified by that.
Well, we just got through with Nate Silver suggesting that there may be a political price that the Democrats will pay, and that the people who created the mess only a couple of years ago will be rewarded, and the Democrats will be punished by stagnation and rising unemployment.
Well, it's quite infuriating, and I can tell you it's quite infuriating to have to go on TV and radio and debate people who recommended the very policies that got us into this mess, now taking pot shots at valiant efforts to clean up the mess and do something for people and limiting our ability to do even more. So, you know, that is the situation. We both have to acknowledge that what the administration and Congress did, it was actually bold and effective and is having an effect. But that it has to be more, you know, that we were thrown into a huge hole. Mm-hmm. And we have to get out of that. And people are really hurting, and they need to see some results. They need to see health care reform, as the discussion said, and they need to see some job growth. If they don't, then they, you know, probably will punish the Democrats in November. And that's the way the chips are going to fall.
Well, one would think that the messaging should be clearer about standing up for Main Street as opposed to rescuing Wall Street. I mean, it seems that when you look at what's been going on in the comments from Sheila Bair and others that are sort of seem to be fighting the battle in Treasury and for the American people, as opposed to Summers and others who are part of the kind of Goldman Sachs alumni. I mean, it's pretty clear what's happened there. These banks that have been bailed out have got stronger, and they're creating an even greater moral hazard because of the reason we got into the problem in the first place was that there was this belief that they were too big to fail, but now they're even bigger. So therefore, yeah, they're too big to fail. Applies, and if you're too big to fail, you're in effect free to go out and take risks, the kind of risks that got us into trouble in the first place, because you know that the government's going to bail you out. So it seems to me that this has been double jeopardy for the taxpayers of this country. They bailed out people who have gotten richer, more powerful, more influential, and are putting the economy in greater jeopardy. They're the only ones that seem to be recovering. It's a jobless recovery, except for these people who've frankly, seem to extract wealth. It's the working people of this country who create wealth.
Well, I agree with your sentiments. I think that the one area where the administration has fallen short is I think it hasn't taken it to Wall Street sufficiently. And I think people are beset by hearing about trillion-dollar programs to bail out the banks, and then $1 trillion for health care, and $1 trillion
General Motors
recovery package,
yeah.
And more. I think helping out General Motors and Chrysler was a very important and wise thing to do. I know it's even more unpopular than the banks, but I think there were millions and millions of jobs at risk. I think stabilizing those companies and manufacturing in the Midwest is an important thing to have done, as it has been the cash for clunkers. I think the bailout has muddied the water here, but I think it's also true that there's a lot of things that the administration has done, including the recovery package and other things that I think are really on the side of workers. And having lived through 8 years of George Bush, which everything was wildly against working people, and the Clinton years where that was quite a mixed bag. So I think we're in a much better shape, actually. And Larry Summers had some wrong ideas in the late 1990s, and some of those he's reversed. And a lot of what they've done outside of the banking, I think, has been pretty good. And we'll see what's happening with healthcare. But I don't actually demonize him at this point. But I think it's also important that people who are progressive have to do what they can, not only to push the administration, but to make room for them to have their better lights shined. They've been defeated at every turn every time they've tried to raise taxes on the rich. If they keep on losing like that, we'll never be able to maintain the spending programs, investments, social safety net that we want, especially as we need to get the deficits down a couple years from now. We can't get health care now because they're trying to, get health care reform by taking it out of, Medicare, and they're afraid to pull the trigger on taxes for the rich and other things. As long as you are not able to do that, we're going to be in a hole. And that's what the right wing basically did over 30 years, is to put progressives in that hole.
But but the amazing thing is that they managed to get the so-called Reagan Democrats to vote against their own interest by supporting tax cuts for the rich, believing that somehow they would benefit. I mean, and in fact, under Ronald Reagan, when the rich got their taxes cut, he brought in a payroll tax, which made up for some of the deficit, which was the most punitive tax you could possibly have against working people, and effectively punishing them for having jobs.
Well, he also was reelected in 1984 when there was a very rapid recovery from a very deep recession. And that's the problem that President Obama is going to face, which is that there will be a recovery and it won't be robust, and then we'll probably Democrats will pay a price in 2010, and we'll see what happens in 2012. But I think that things won't be swimmingly well even by 2012, I fear.
So why can't the White House make a stronger and more focused message on the healthcare debate? Not that it's clear what this package is, and perhaps there'll be some more clarity on Wednesday night when the president addresses the Congress. But nevertheless, it's pretty clear that the wealthy have gotten away with enormous amount of tax cuts, and that's $1.7 trillion there that could be rolled back. One of the giveaways to the insurance companies was Medicare Advantage, which was a straightforward subsidy to insurance companies. There's some savings there. If you go through the list, and even if you don't get to issues fundamental like how we have tremendous amount of obesity and diabetes and smoking related and all these lifestyle things that that could be addressed and systemically save money. It just seems to me, I'd love somebody on the side of trying to sell this healthcare bill to be able to do the math and show how broken the system is and how much money you can save just by cleaning up the status quo.
Well, I think that a lot of people would like to see that done as well, and I agree with you. And I think you know, it's a messy process making legislation, and I think that's bedeviled the president because there's a lot of competing plans out there. A lot of what people want is in there, and frankly, they've been out-organized. The whole progressive movement has been out-organized. If we think that the people want what we want, and I still believe that, then we have to build the organizations and do the work that's actually going to mobilize people and voice that. And, you know, the right wing is out mobilizing our team right now. And the president, you know, is stuck. You know, at the same time as, of course, I don't believe any of the Republicans really want to do anything reasonable. I think many of the American people really expect the president to try to win over some Republicans. So that puts you in a pretty bad way. Hopefully they'll turn the corner this week and be clear about what they want and do what they have to do to win something important, that not only they can declare victory, which I think is important, but that actually will be a victory for working people. Even the bills that are in there right now, because they're so scared of raising costs, won't even benefit people until, you know, 3 years from now. So we will pass a bill this year, but a lot of the benefits of it won't really take place for a while, and people will be wondering even if there's a victory, so, you know, what actually happened.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Lawrence Michel, economist, president of the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan economic research institution in Washington, D.C., and he's the author, co-author, along with Heidi Shierholz, of a new study just released, The Recession's Hidden Costs. And we're talking on this Labor Day weekend about the state of the economy, particularly in terms of unemployment. But just in the closing minutes here, Dr. Michel, reflecting on the state of labor and on Labor Day, clearly a huge percentage of the workforce is not unionized, and there was an expectation that maybe President Obama might be able to turn that around. But with so much on his plate now, with these wars that he inherited and this economic meltdown where we were on the brink of global economic collapse and the enormous amount of money that's had to be spent to into that black hole. And frankly, we still don't know how that black hole is because all those toxic assets are somewhere out there, you know, alchemically being disguised, albeit, but they're there. And then he's had to throw a lot of money in to get people to stimulate the economy. It does seem that the Employee Free Choice Act is just has to be on the back burner now.
Well, I think there will be some really robust reform of our labor laws either this fall or very early next year. I think the president is committed to doing the work to make that get done after health care. And, in fact, I think he'll be a lot better at doing so, more committed to it than we ever saw in the Clinton and Carter administrations, although that's a pretty low bar. So I'm hopeful that there's going to be some real reform that's going to really matter to working people. Half the people in this country who are non-union indicate in poll after poll that they would like the chance to be a member of a union and have the benefits of collective bargaining, and believe their coworkers feel the same way. So I hope that we can do something. I don't think we're ever going to fix the problem we started out this discussion about, which is that people are producing a lot more per hour work per person, but their hourly compensation, their pay, doesn't really grow accordingly. They've basically been ripped off for 30-some-odd years. To turn that around, we have to really build a different kind of institutional structure in the labor market. People need to have unions. We need a much higher minimum wage. We need to have laws that we enforce around overtime and the minimum wage and safety and health standards. And we need things like health care for everybody so that everyone employed has health care. Everybody also needs to be able to get retirement security, which is a whole other discussion that this country hasn't even warmed up to yet, now that everyone's suffering from having a 201K. You know, that's what I think is ahead. You know, there's a lot of struggles to do this. There's people on the other side who are just dead set against progress and are wedded to a tried and failed ideology. hopefully progressives can convince the American people that the ideology of the, you know, business rules, labor, you know, free markets are always good, government is always bad. We have to really overcome that to be able to put government on the side of the people.
What a concept. Government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Yeah.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Lawrence Michel.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Dr. Lawrence Michel, an economist, president of the Economic Policy Institute. They do a biannual authoritative text on the American workforce, the state of working America. And he, along with the economist Heidi Scheholtz, have just released a paper, The Recession's Hidden Costs. And now turning to examine the situation of those who actually have jobs and are being cheated by their employers, we're joined by Dr. Ruth Milkman, who is a professor of sociology at UCLA, where she's also the director of the UCLA Institute of Industrial Reforms, Relations, I should say, and Dr. Nick Theodore is director of the Center for Urban Economic Development and an associate professor in the Department of Urban Planning and Policy at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Both Dr. Milkman and Dr. Theodore are part of a team of national labor market experts who have just released a groundbreaking study of the low-wage workforce in the nation's three largest cities, finding that core employment laws like the minimum wage and overtime pay are being aggressively and systematically violated in some of the economy's fastest-growing industries. Their report, entitled Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers, Violations of Labor Laws in American Cities, can be viewed at www.unprotectedworkers.org/broken laws. Dr. Ruth Milkman, given that we've had such gloomy unemployment figures of 9.7, and if you add in the workers who work part-time and want to have a full-time job, and those who've given up looking for work, the figure is actually 16.8%. But on top of that, you revealed that those people who do have jobs, the lower-paying jobs, are in fact being cheated in a systematic and wholesale way.
Yes, many of them are. We did this research in 2008 before the full scope of the recession had really hit. So at the time we collected our data, we found very high prevalence of wage theft and other workplace violations. And although we don't have data on the current year, we suspect that the situation has deteriorated further thanks to the recession, which makes it much harder for people to simply quit a problematic job and look for something else.
And these are people that like restaurant workers, nurses, warehouse workers.
Well, we didn't include nurses, but it's roughly the bottom 15% of the labor market in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York City. There are about 20 industries and occupations that we focused on. So nurses is more of a professional job, but we did look at, you know, nursing assistants.
That's what I mean. I'm sorry. Yeah.
So,
Dr. Theodore, even though that you did the study before the economy tanked, and presumably statistics will be worse now, on this Labor Day weekend, just broadening out a little bit, some of the basic statistics about working America, and I know that you dealt with the low-wage workers, is just run through some of them. 84% who've been unemployed got no severance pay. 63% have used their savings and retirement money. 56% are without unemployment insurance. 56% had to borrow money from family and friends. 53% are without health insurance. 34% have increased their credit card debt. 25% have missed a mortgage payment or rent payment. And 17% have been forced to move. A pretty grim landscape.
Yeah, without question. I think working families in this country are really suffering at this time, and I think our study has shown, especially those that are earning low and moderate income wages, that the pressures are considerable. We find widespread violations of basic laws like overtime laws, minimum wage laws, employers requiring workers to work off the clock, and so on. And this is really squeezing working families at a time where they're just simply not in a position to bear these costs.
And Dr. Milkman says some of these statistics ought to indicate that 55% of workers are angry, 54% feel hopeless. But it would seem that in this environment, if you have a job, you may be bitter and angry, but you're also coward and desperately trying to hold on to it, and therefore vulnerable to being exploited because you don't want to lose your house, your car, and your health care.
Absolutely. I mean, even in good times, people think twice about complaining about a problem on the job because of the fear of either retaliation in the form of being fired outright or some other kind of punishment. And we did find that. We asked workers if they had a problem, and many of them said they had a problem, but they didn't complain either because they feared retaliation or they figured nothing would happen if they did complain. And there was, those who did complain faced retaliation at very high levels. So all of that is much more true today than it was a year ago when we completed the data collection for this study, given that, if you lose your job, it's very hard to find another one at the moment.
So what about this new Department of Labor, led by Hilda Solis, who comes from a family with a background in labor? Clearly, there hasn't been any advocacy for the working people, and we were just talking to an economist earlier that the paradox in this environment where Wall Street's all but brought the global economy to the brink of collapse and yet been rewarded by the hard-pressed taxpayer, you have a dichotomy between those at the top who are making endless amounts of money and not paying taxes, who seem to extract wealth, and those at the bottom who create wealth are not being compensated. It's a very, very stark dysfunctional system, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, and that's been under development for several decades now. I do think that it's great that the Obama administration has appointed Hilda Solis as Secretary of Labor. She's actually here from Southern California, from El Monte originally, and very much aware of these problems and these issues. She has her work cut out for her because the agency she now heads has deteriorated greatly under the previous administration. It hasn't been funded properly. It has not been staffed properly. So she is indicated a commitment to trying to fix that, but I don't think we should expect results overnight. It's a very big job.
And Dr. Theodore, there have been some indications that that there's been some advocacy for workers. In December, Walmart, last December, Walmart announced that it would settle 63 cases in 42 states where they've been charged for unpaid workers' salaries, totaling $352 million. And this involved hundreds of thousands of current and former workers. So is that something that we can see more of?
Right. I think there have been a number of high-profile cases in recent years that have exposed the kind of working conditions that we documented here in this study. And it's important that those cases come to light and set an example for other employers. But our study, I think, shows that this is a widespread phenomenon that is not confined to any one industry or one set of employers, and a problem that really demands urgent attention on the part of the U.S. Department of Labor and states' departments of labor to aggressively renew its commitment to enforcing our basic core labor standards.
So how does this gel with our sort of egalitarian ethos that as a nation? It seems to me that the more that I talk to you and the more that we look at these statistics, which most people don't seem to focus on, it's more as though one of the richest guys in the world recently, Berkshire Hathaway, recently said that we are in danger of becoming a plantation economy. Dr. Milkman, doesn't it starting to look that way?
Well, I think that's right. If something isn't done to try to turn things around, we will have a income distribution that more resembles that of a country like Brazil than what, you know, the European competitors of the U.S. Economic leading companies. And so, you know, that is a real danger. And we hope that our study is helping to call attention to, you know, some of the most extreme abuses that occur as a result. I'll just mention one other thing, which is I think that a lot of the workplace violations that we documented for the lower wage part of the labor market extend quite a bit further up. Now, we don't have any data on that, but just in the time since we released the report, we've received a number of communications from people saying, hey, you know, this isn't just low-wage workers. I don't get paid for overtime either, and that sort of thing. So I think that actually the problem is even bigger than what we were able to document in this one study.
And Dr. Theodore, one would think politically, we were talking earlier with Nate Silver about how the Democrats may suffer a backlash or some buyer's remorse from their resounding victory in 2008. And 2 years later, 2010, they may lose a bunch of seats, which does seem fickle, but there's a perception, perhaps, that's being exploited by the Republicans of paralysis, and it seems to me that the messaging from the White House hasn't been very focused in terms of who they're standing up for, Main Street as opposed to Wall Street. And you'd think that statements like the one that I just quoted from Warren Buffett that we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy, surely that Couldn't you refocus the working class and the middle class in this country to recognize how much they are in jeopardy, how much they've been eviscerated, and at the same time point out that this is the measure of a successful democratic pluralistic society, is to have a strong, vibrant middle class. Who wants to go to live in a third world country?
I agree with you completely. The pain has been so deep, the pain has been so widespread, that if the current administration were to continue with some leadership in this area, I think it would receive widespread support from the voting public. This is a problem, the problem of insecurity and economic insecurity, and the difficulties that families are facing stretches up the economic hierarchy, up the spectrum, and more families are feeling the push from unemployment, the insecurities around jobs, and so on. And so strong leadership from the U.S. Department of Labor and from the president, I think, would resonate widely throughout the country.
And Dr. Milkman, if you look at how household income has been flat for decades and this is not just in the U.S., it's throughout the advanced economies, and yet productivity has risen, and it's pretty clear, and from all these graphs and statistics, that capital has been the beneficiary from improved productivity, and labor hasn't been rewarded. And Bloomberg just reported a couple of days ago, quoting J.P. Morgan Chase's economist and former Federal Reserve official Michael Feroli, saying this current jobless recovery is great for business and terrible for households. So again, you'd think that there'd be some better messaging from the White House.
Well, I agree with you completely. I mean, that is a new development, this gap between productivity increases and real income increases for working people. From World War II to about the mid-70s, those two things sort of went hand in hand. When productivity went up, so did real incomes. And in the recent three decades, that link has been broken. And it's true that it's not just in the United States, but we are one of the most extreme examples.
There's
a real need for both action from the administration and many others. And also, I must say, from organized labor, from anybody who cares about these issues, we all have a responsibility to try to do what we can to turn things around. It's a big job. There's been 30 years of this. And so, it's not going to turn on a dime. But I agree with Nick that some leadership and shining a bright light on these problems like you're attempting to do in this show and we try to do in our study is one contribution one can make to this effort.
And just in closing, given what's on President Obama's plate with the floundering health care initiative, the stimulus, these wars he's inherited, where do you think it's the Employees' Free Choice Act? Is it on the back burner or is it likely to come to the front burner?
Is that for me or for Nick?
Both of you. Start with you.
Okay. I think that with the death of Ted Kennedy, it's a little bit in limbo at the moment because they had just gotten those 60 votes that they needed to get it through the Senate without a filibuster. And so presumably whoever replaces Kennedy will supply that 60th vote, but I suspect you won't hear about it for a little bit until that matter is settled.
And quickly, Nick, just in the last minute, what's your reading on that?
Right. I think the Employee Free Choice Act is out there on the agenda. Immigration reform, another area that affects the way in which the labor market operates, is out there. And I think the healthcare debate obviously is commanding a lot of attention. So the president has his hands full and his administration, their hands full in dealing with these issues. But I think there is a recognition, I hope, that we cannot build a healthy economy on the backs of substandard employment conditions, and that the issues we raise here in this report and others have been raising demand urgent attention from this administration, despite all the other challenges that lay before us.
Well, I thank you both for joining us, Dr. Ruth Milkman and Dr. Nick Theodore, co-authors of Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers, Violations for Labor Laws in American Cities. You can access their report at www.unprotectedworkers.org/Broken Laws. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. Bye for now.